Today's program is brought to you by the Museum of Food and Drink, sparking curiosity about food with exhibits you can eat. For more information, visit mofad.org.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network, broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome to Food Without Borders, a show about food, politics, and all the ways that immigrants make our food system more delicious. I'm your host, Sari Kamen. My guest today is Fanny Gerson. She's the founder of Dough Donuts and La New Yorkina, a company that aims to share the sweetness and culture of Mexico. She's the author of My Sweet Mexico, Paletas, and the forthcoming Mexican Ice Cream, Beloved Recipes and Stories. Hi, Fanny. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. There's a lot going on, first of all. There's a lot going on in the food world and in the political world.
Yes. Yes, there is.
Yeah. So first, you know, before we kind of get into both, why don't you tell me a little bit about your story? You're from Mexico City.
Mm-hmm. I was born and raised in Mexico City, mm-hmm. even though I don't have a very Mexican name.
Not a very Mexican name, but kind of a Mexican accent. I can still hear it.
I have a bit of an accent. And my great-grandparents from my father's side actually immigrated to Mexico from Eastern Europe. So it's an immigrant...
An immigrant day.
Yes.
Are there a lot of Mexican immigrants from Eastern Europe? I feel like you don't hear about that very often.
Well, there is, you know, there's not a lot compared to like, you know,
the
Jewish community in Mexico is small, but mm-hmm. I'd like to say we make some noise. So, and actually my grandmother was going to come to New York. So she was, they were scheduled, she was an only child, so her parents and her, she was very young, to go on the boat, but then she got sick. She had a cold, and back then having a cold was a huge deal.
Yeah.
So she wasn't allowed in the boat. They had to wait several months to be able to get another one, but by the time she was able to go on that second boat, there were no more entries into the United States. Mm-hmm. They had closed the entry. So they had heard from, I don't know, like someone that knew someone that knew someone that Mexico was another place they could go to. And they went there. But the intention was just to be there until they reopened the borders. But once they reopened the borders, they had, you know, started to make a home mm-hmm. in Mexico.
That is so interesting. And as a result, you are Mexican.
Yes, as a result, I am Mexican. And I've been in this country for about 20 years now.
You came here for school. For culinary school.
Yeah. So I studied upstate at the Culinary Institute of America, mm-hmm. and I've been here ever since. I just left to do my externship in Spain for a year, and was in Mexico briefly, and then back to New York.
Yeah. So a lot's changed since you first came to the United States.
Yes.
Which was. In the late 90s?
It was in the late 90s. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. So so this is a show about, you know, food and politics and immigrant culture. And you're someone, you know, I read the article in Grub Street. You own two different food businesses that both kind of focus on Mexican foods. And I know, you know, living in New York City, everyone says, oh, it's, you know, it's a bubble. Which to me is kind of an offensive thing to say. I personally don't think that New York City is a bubble because we interact with people of every ethnicity, every race, every religion, mm-hmm. every single day on the subway, in the streets. And, you know, obviously there's people in other parts of the country who aren't exposed to, you know, such a diverse range of people on their day to day. So saying New York City is a bubble when, you know, we're the ones that are actually...
Yeah.
Like, we know from immigrants. Like, we know from refugees.
Yeah.
So I sort of resent the fact when people call us the bubble. Not that this is like an us versus them, but, you know, I know you're in New York City, so you might have a different perspective of what it might feel like to own, you know, a Mexican-focused food business. But how does it feel in light of everything that's happening, like with the, you know, the rhetoric about Mexicans being rapists and the build the wall and whatnot?
Yeah, I mean, I get what you're saying about the bubble, but I do understand sort of like mm-hmm. where you're coming from and where they're coming from. Like, I think that as an immigrant, whether you have a business or not, being in New York, you feel protected,
right?
You know, even undocumented workers feel protected. You know,
it's almost like a shield.
It's like
as
a
opposed
shield,
to a bubble.
You know, so yeah. Exactly. So I think that maybe that would be a better choice of words.
Right.
So for La Neoyorquina, I specifically focus on Mexico and the sweetness of Mexico. And at Dough, it's a little bit of everything. There's always like, because it's, I create the flavors, but it's not. And a lot of them are inspired by Mexico, but we also do some other flavors that
aren't.
Dough
is
and
less
so
obviously a
it's
Mexican
less obvious,
food
you know.
Company.
So
yeah,
you know, and I do flavors like a matcha donut or
yeah.
some things like that. But
and I think people are surprised sometimes when they find out that you are
yes.
also La Neoyorquina and Dough, that you're the
yes,
same person.
Exactly.
Mostly like, how do you have time?
Yeah, I don't sleep a lot. And I have, you know, a lot of support.
Yeah.
But mainly I don't sleep a lot. But I do have to say that it's a scary time, because also a lot of the political climate, you know, or whatever you want to call it, is also very, you know, so far it's targeted specific countries. And Mexico is one of the main ones, even in the campaign. So that creates, you know, so for me, it's scary both as a Mexican and, you know, and living here in you know, having a Mexican business. And so I'm worried for, you know, people in Mexico and people here, not just, I mean, I worry in general, but it hits particularly.
There's just a lot to worry
there's
about.
There's a lot
right
to
now.
Worry
yeah.
about. And I remember within the first week of the election results, somebody was walking by the store and said, because it says like Mexican ice and sweets. And he was like, Mexican, you know, and we've heard that a couple of times.
Really?
And even in New York. And I'm like, if we feel it here, what is it? You know, but
I guess that's the bubble part, is that, again, I think it's a shield. And, mm-hmm. you know, what I resent about it is when people say it in a way that's pejorative, because I think it's, if anything, it's a positive that we're shielded from that sort of rhetoric.
Yes.
You know, that does exist probably.
Exactly. But I still feel it. And, you know, we have employees that are worried for their family members. Yeah. And I mean, and that goes throughout, you know, most of the kitchens are, you know, Latin, or not most of them, but, you know, there's a large percentage of Latin workers in all of the U.S.
Right.
And it's the backbone.
I mean, is there a disconnect that seems to be happening in the United States with understanding how the food system, how the food industry and the restaurant industry works?
There's a complete, not just disconnect, but to me, utter ignorance. Mm-hmm. You know, like, first, you know, all the fact is like, oh, go back to your country. You know, like, they're criminals. You know, just being undocumented is not equal being a criminal, mm-hmm. you know, and most of the people that came here, you know, in that way, they risked a lot to be here. They risked their lives. They left so much at home, and they don't really want to be here for the most part. They would like to go back home, but there's not, you know, the opportunities in Mexico and in El Salvador and in many countries, you know, they are not ideal. There's not a lot of opportunity. So people go in the same way that my great-grandparents immigrated, you know, trying to have a better life for them and for their family. So there's a complete disconnect. And, you know, and then other people say, well, but they're doing the work that Americans don't want to do. Right. And perhaps that's there's a bit of truth in that. But I think more importantly, there's a really big disconnect without understanding how or why. Nobody ever questions the people that are against all of this, don't take the time to really question or even ask, you know, what it took for them to be here and what they're doing. And by the way, they do pay taxes, because mm-hmm. that's another thing that they talk about. So they contribute to the society, they contribute to the economy, you know, and, you know, what about people that live here that take advantage of the welfare system, or, you know what I mean? It's not black and white, but I think in order for people to really have a strong opinion, you need to get educated.
Sure.
But they should.
But of course, it's, you know, the people who tend to have a strong opinion, you know, there's an emotional response that's easily triggered and
definitely
manipulated.
In both sides.
Both sides. Yeah. So what is someone who owns a business, What are you taking any precautions at this point? Are you talking with other business owners in terms of, you know, how you guys can kind of collaborate together and create kind of a protections for some of your workers, or if there's some sort of plan that's happening just in case, you know, ICE comes into your restaurants and starts rounding up workers?
Yeah, I think...
I mean, not to say that any of yours are undocumented.
Yes,
but,
yes.
Yeah.
No, and that you bring up a very good point. You know...
What is the responsibility of a restaurant owner?
I think a responsibility and something that, you know, I've done with friends and colleagues, it's just... you know, as the, like, spreading the information, because a lot of this stuff is changing every day, you know, depending on the Twitter mood that the president is in.
We'll call him the Twitter.
You know? Yes. Mm-hmm. And so it's just sharing that information amongst ourselves so we can pass it along. And then it's reassuring our staff and really just focusing, you know, I do have to say, like, if in seeing the silver lining in things,
sure.
It has made people more aware and more engaged and more, you know.
I mean, you can't dispute that, of course.
No.
If there is one thing the tweeter has accomplished in unifying the country, it might be unifying them against him.
Yes, exactly.
Not the entire country, of course, but
yes, so,
I would say the majority.
So I think that is a good thing. But it's, you know, for me also, just even there's a whole other aspect, which is the financial aspect. You know, I import a lot of my ingredients because sourcing is extremely important to me. So I bring chocolate from Oaxaca and vanilla beans from Mexico, from Veracruz, you know, like a lot of stuff, because I want to support the Mexican economy and small growers as much as I can of things that don't grow here.
And be authentic about the ingredients you're using.
Yeah. And, you know, I could use a commercial brand that's going to, you know, that doesn't have trouble. What, it doesn't matter if they raise the taxes or if the NAFTA agreement, you know, stops happening. But that's a deep concern, you know, and it's not. I mean, I'm just a little... little company, but it trickles down. So, you know,
let's just say guacamole is going to be more than $2 at Chipotle.
Yes, exactly. You know, if there is, it becomes like a luxury item. And, you know, that's like the vanilla bean from Mexico is already expensive.
Yeah.
And right now we're trying to figure out, because it just went up, you know, three times as much. Our chocolate was held up at the border, which hadn't happened before. Eventually it came,
God.
But you know, it's like the little things, and it's like, what are you going to do? And then it affects us. It affects, you know, what, you know, the business, but it also affects the people, you know, the producer, the one, you know, it's a whole chain.
Yeah.
And I'm just talking about like one ingredient.
No, I mean, I remember we had a discussion, cause you came on the previous show that I used to host here, The Morning After. And it was during a time when it was very difficult to get limes from Mexico.
Yes, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And
it was,
we were
very
having
expensive.
That conversation.
And it was for a whole different,
because of drug cartel.
Because of drug cartels.
Yeah. And that was temporary. Luckily.
Yes. And and they went up so much. I remember.
So much.
Like $150.
All bartenders were saying like, I'm sorry, I can't garnish your drink with a lime, would
drink.
Be like a,
yeah.
you know, a ridiculous luxury right now.
Exactly. You know, and for me, I also, you know, I'm continuously trying to show people that, you know, Mexican food is as sophisticated as many others. And I've heard, you know, David Chang say something similar about mm-hmm. a lot of Asian food, that, you know, people, if you know, what is it about certain food like Italian? You know, I use the example of gelato because that's closest to what I make. So if you go to a gelato shop that's just you know, a normal, not, you know, it could be an average one. It could be actually even a crappy one. But because it has the word gelato, if you charge, I don't know, I'm just throwing out a number, but let's say $6 for a medium or, you know, something like that, and you charge the same, but this is a Mexican ice cream shop, people are often like, oh, that's too expensive, you know? And because there's an association that because it's comes from a third world, or it becomes, you know, if it's ethnic, it should be cheaper.
Yeah.
So if I, you know, to me, there's a whole education. This is actually, you know, we're sourcing from really good places. We use dairy from upstate New York, and we bring, you know, all these ingredients from Mexico or the farmer's market or whatever. And, you know, we have a lot of offerings that other people don't have. And so you already have that barrier. And then if on top of that, it makes it much more difficult to get the ingredients. And then you have a staff that, you know, is concerned about either their well-being, their family's well-being, or the future of their country. And then there's uncertainty all around. So I think that it's a very scary time.
Yeah,
for sure. But also, you know, it's the time you just like, you hold each other, and it's, you know, I remember, I don't know if you were here right after the election results, but I remember the feeling was sort of this, and it still is, but particularly the first few weeks, like a collective grievance, you know?
I mean, by here, you mean like buried under my blanket sobbing. I was in a way here.
Yes, exactly. And so now I feel like it's time to be like, you know, in the same way that in the grieving stages, yes, that you go to, like, it's time to be like,
it's
collectively holding each other's hands, yeah, and, you know, helping each other push, mm-hmm, push through.
You brought up such a good point, and I want to come back to that idea that you know, there's this stigma attached to certain ethnic cuisines, but not all ethnic cuisines, that, mm-hmm, some are more refined than others for, mm-hmm, for whatever reason. Like, there's, you know, a French culinary tradition. So French restaurants are, you know, considered gourmet, but, you know, there's the issue. It's like people don't understand why, like, you know, Alex Stupak is charging X amount of money for a taco when it's just a taco.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a whole issue of appropriation there. But so do you think, because it's like, I'm trying to figure out what role food plays in all of this, like the way that we perceive certain ethnic groups is because maybe the way that like the food fits into the larger conversation, you know, the six countries that have been targeted in this Muslim ban, they're not cuisines that we necessarily associate with like fine dining. We don't have an understanding of them being like an important part in the culinary sort of trajectory. If we had more experience with these cuisines, like in our day-to-day understanding of what like gourmet food could be,
mm-hmm,
like especially in different parts of the country, you know, like in New York, we have every single kind of food. And I think that has a lot to do with like why we don't have such flagrant,
yes,
racism necessarily, or like not racism, but like intolerance.
Yes.
It's because we eat all this different kind of food. And so like, you know, therefore we have like a better understanding of who the people are that are cooking our foods and where they come from. Do you think if different types of ethnic cuisine, like specifically Middle Eastern cuisine, played a more, you know, front and center, like significant role in our food culture, there would be more tolerance?
Well,
I know that's like a lot to unpack, and it's,
yes,
kind of like,
I mean, I do, you know, food definitely
but
plays
like,
a big
even
role
with Mexican,
in conversation.
It's like, because it's so easy to dismiss it as like cheap or,
yeah,
you know,
so that's what I was going to say. Like,
yeah,
you know, food definitely brings people together and gives you a glimpse of somebody's culture and in many ways. But, you know, food from those countries may not be well known, but Mexican food is very well known, and it still has that association for a lot of people. It has a negative connotation.
Yeah.
And it, you know, in the same way that they see, a lot of people see Mexican food as like a Taco Bell and cheap or whatever, then they assume like, oh, well, the people that are, you know, it's like a superiority,
yeah,
thing. And then you go into like, well, is it perhaps, you know, it's about whiteness, you know,
yeah,
maybe the countries that have predominantly white people making them, or they come from white cultures, you know, perhaps there's something there. I mean, I don't know. I'm not a sociologist or anthropologist, but that's a very interesting thing to think about it that way, because why is it that certain countries in Europe have, even in Europe, have more of a sort of a pass.
A pass, yeah.
Or a high end. You know, and I think that every country has a lot to offer. But, you know, going back to sort of one of the good things is I see a lot of friends and colleagues doing special event dinners, highlighting foods from these parts of the world, because they tend to be grouped all together. You know, it's like Arab food.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Just as a whole. And then that is a very limited vocabulary for a lot of people, you know, like even for us. And so I think that exposure and but also the support that from that band, the immediacy of the reaction of the people has been amazing, you know? So I think that must be, you know, something that we hold on to.
Yeah. We're going to take a quick break and then we'll talk more with Fanny.
Hi, I'm Dave Arnold, the host of Cooking Issues on the Heritage Radio Network. We all know and love Chinese takeout dishes like General Tso's chicken and egg rolls, but here's the thing. Even though we call it Chinese food, it's not like the food you'd find in China. What's the story behind this cuisine, and how did it become so popular that you can find a Chinese-American restaurant in nearly every town in the country? The answers may surprise you. Visit the Museum of Food and Drink in Brooklyn and see our newest exhibition, Chow, Making the Chinese-American Restaurant. Chow engages visitors with compelling accounts of how Chinese immigrants overcame racism and created Chinese-American cuisine. Discover the science behind the flavors of your favorite takeout dishes, feast on rotating tastings developed by the country's most talented Chinese-American chefs, and try your hand at writing your own fortune, which will be baked into actual cookies by a 1,500-pound fortune cookie machine. What better way to learn, connect, and eat? You can visit Chow at the Museum of Food and Drink on Fridays through Sundays from noon to 6. Tickets and more information can be found at mofad.org.
And we're back. You're listening to Food Without Borders on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Sari Kamen, and I'm in studio with Fanny Gerson from Dough Donuts and La New Yorkina, which sells delicious Mexican sweets like paletas. Hi, Fanny.
Hi.
We've been talking a lot about food and politics, and I want to hear a little bit about what's going on with you. Let's take a deep breath, step away from the political conversation. You have a new cookbook coming out.
I do.
Can you talk about that?
I'm so excited. Yes.
I'm so excited.
I am so
Mexican
excited.
Ice cream. Oh, my God.
Yeah, Mexican ice cream. So
how's that different than paletas, or especially like your cookbook?
Well, it's a bigger book, and it's really, you know, it's kind of in between My Sweet Mexico, which was my first book, and Paletas in every way. So it has sort of the depth in research that I did for My Sweet Mexico, and, you know, a lot of storytelling, whereas Paletas is more straightforward, you know, and a fun, delicious read. And so this book is sort of one... I mean, in everything that I do, I hope that you're transported in Mexico. But it's really about the people and the traditions and trying to document, to give continuity. And Mexico may not be known, even for a lot of Mexicans, I have to say, as, you know, this very interesting or particularly good ice cream place. You know, it's not like...
It's not the first thing that comes to mind.
It's not the first thing that comes to mind. You know, people talk about ice cream in Argentina, or gelatos, or kulfi in India, but it doesn't have, or Turkish ice cream, you know? But I think it's embedded in the culture in a way that people don't even see it as a... You know, because it's not something you see like in every corner. the way that you see in other places.
But so, I think that you have the ability to take, you know, to look, you know, in terms of like your sourcing and bring out really interesting flavors and then create ice creams that are really surprising, that aren't like the flavors are always traditional or the ingredients are always traditional, but you know, not everyone's necessarily making ice creams in the same way that you
are. Yeah, well, I try to pay, you know, homage to what I see. But in Mexico, what's really interesting is, you know, what we were talking about before, how, you know, one cuisine gets grouped. So that happens, is very true for Mexican restaurants. You know, most of the restaurants, you know, say it's Mexican food. But there's regionalities that are very present in the cuisine. So, and in ice cream, there's certain ice creams that you can only get in that particular town or in that particular city. And then the traditional way of making ice cream is this thing called nieve de garrafa. So it's a wooden barrel with a cylinder in the center with ice. So very similar to like a churn, but you don't churn it. It's a big long paddle and you paddle it. And you know, there's a role for most, I would say, if I had to guess, you know, like 90% of them are family owned businesses, if not more. And for the most part, the women are the ones who prepare the base of the ice cream and sorbet. And a lot of them don't give out the recipes, even to their other members of the family. And then for the most part, it's mainly the men that do the paddling, because it's very heavy work. There are some women who do it, but you know, there's this woman, there's a stand in a town called Pátzcuaro. It's this beautiful little town in the center of Mexico, and the woman, I forget how old she is, but she's, I think she told me she's close to 90, and she's one of those women, and she's just starting to show her son how to make the bases, and she wakes up every day between 5 and 6 a.m. They get the fruit. It's incredible.
That's amazing.
And it's like that. They have so many stories. There's another shop in another part of Mexico that specializes in sorbets. They have a ton of flavors, but what really sets them apart in this town, particular town that has tons of ice cream, they specialize in sorbets and ice cream made from different cactus fruits.
Wow.
But not just the ones that you see all over Mexico. Some that only grow in that region in a specific time of year in the mountains. And so there's so many very special things. Now,
that must
of course,
have been the most fun book to research ever.
Yes. I love, you know, I have to say that for me, the best part of the book process is the research.
Yeah.
And I wish I could take. So I, when I write, I want to take the reader to at least part of what
I want
experience.
To go there.
Yes, you want to go there. So until or if you can't go, maybe you can go through.
Okay,
through
fair enough.
Yeah.
Settle for that.
And, you know, a lot of those things I couldn't put in the book. I could talk about them.
Well, yeah. I mean, how do you translate what you just described with, like, paddling in a barrel? I mean, how do you instruct, like, a home cook or someone who's curious?
I mean, there is a way that you can do it. But to be honest, and I was thinking about this, you just made me think about this, actually. Because a lot of the home machines, you know, they don't make the same kind of ice cream mm-hmm. as the one we use for our shop. You know, the ice cream is a little bit icier. It's a little bit less creamy because, you know, it's just the equipment, right? Like what you can do. So that produces closer to what it is. In the handmade, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But also, you know, it's for me, it's taking the essence of that and then trying to do that for the home cook, you know, and or, you know, if they're a pastry chef, for it to inspire new flavors or, you know, and I started my career in the savory side. Mm. So I think more like a savory chef, and I want people to sort of use it as base of inspiration. Because if they're not going to be able to get good mangoes where they are, you know, but maybe that kind of flavor profile or the description of it will make them want to try it out with something else. You know what
well,
I mean?
Well, that's what I mean about like your flavors often being surprising and like on paper can be sort of challenging. And
yes.
I love that about your ice cream. You know, it's just, it's really unexpected and it's so playful and it's so
thank
creative.
Thank you. Yeah. And you know, like I love sorbet. I think sorbet gets really overlooked in other parts, in a lot of, I mean, outside of a lot of Latin countries, and I'm sure many others. But in Mexico, if you go to an ice cream shop, you'll see at least half, if not more, of the selection being water-based. And I feel a lot of, at least in the U.S., most of the ice cream shops have a couple of selection, and it's mostly for, well, you know, for people that can't eat dairy or don't like it. But it's almost like they're not exciting. You have find lemon, raspberry, mango is the most exotic. But to me, I'm like, I'm all over the sorbets. I love fruit. I think that they're very... you know, Mexico, you go to any house in Mexico and you're going to find a huge bowl of fruit of whatever's in season, no matter where you go.
Yeah, so, but isn't the fruit just so much better there? Isn't that part of why?
Yes, I think yes, that is a good point, for sure.
That's right on your parade, but...
Yes, no.
I do want to eat more fruit in Mexico.
And also here it's colder, so like right now I crave more of an ice cream.
Right.
You know, but... So I try to have a lot of options.
Okay, so what kind of sorbets have you been playing with that are beyond the basic like lemon, raspberry, boring stuff?
So we have, like, for example, now at the shop we have an avocado passion fruit, and it's really, really good. So you have the creaminess from the avocado.
I can't even picture those flavors together in a sorbet.
Well, you know, you have the creaminess and the richness of the avocado, but then you have the tanginess. You know, thinking like un guacamole, you have the lime.
I love thinking
right?
about
so, there you go. So somebody's like a sweet guacamole.
Sweet guacamole.
I don't think of it that way, but I know some of our customers do, you know. And we have like a very special one that I did. So for Valentine's Day, talking about politics, you know, in Mexico, Valentine's Day is the day of love and friendship. So, you know, I really don't care for the holiday. I always hated, you know, how when I was younger, you know, if I didn't have a significant other, it would make me feel like crap. Or even if I did, it would make others, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I didn't like that. But I love the fact that in Mexico it's very sort of all inclusive.
I love that too.
And when I was growing up, we would give each other candy and chocolate. So it was very nice. And so I had this whole specials that I wanted to do to celebrate that, you know, at the shop. But I was not feeling it with everything going on politically. And I was like, I just can't. And then I decided to create a special flavor, you know, for my love for Mexico. I mean, for me, everything that I do is about that, but one really special flavor.
I love that.
And I called it Mi Corazón, which means my heart. And, you know, it's like the special and then the sales from that particular flavor, which I'll describe in a second, you know, all the proceeds go to this organization called MALDEF, which is, you know, a leading Latino legal voice in the U.S. protecting human rights. So it's a three-color sorbet, of course, green, white, and red, like the colors of the flag in Mexico. So the green is a cactus, pineapple sorbet. The white is a mezcal with a touch of lime, and the red is a mixed berry hibiscus. So to me, like all of that, the complexity, the layers of colors and flavors, that were just, to me, highlights what the culture is like, you know? And
I think you should make that a permanent flavor.
Yeah, I think we're going to have it.
With the proceeds always going to that organization, because that's just... You know, it's like, it's such a struggle every day. You're like, what is something else I can do to help? And like, that's just a really easy sort of tangible thing. And you get ice cream.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you get ice cream. And then, you know, but I had a friend, he's like, what about you? When are you going to take care of you? And I'm like, oh, don't worry. Like, we'll figure it out because, you know, we're still opening a shop. Like, this is not financially the time for us to be... You know, like...
But just one flavor.
But just one flavor,
right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Like, we can justify it, you know, just one flavor. So I think that there's always something that you can do. And hopefully, you know, whether you buy this sorbet or not, but maybe that inspires someone to do something else or... You know what I mean?
And you always work with another organization, right? With low-income Mexican women?
Yeah, I work with an organization called CREA that I love. And it's an organization that a friend of mine. Well, she became a friend. I didn't know her when I first found the organization. And they support women business owners and entrepreneurs and give them the tools and the education that they need in order for them to succeed. And it started out with like 12 women a few years ago, and I think now they have like 4,000.
Wow.
It's amazing. And actually, they started in this state called Zacatecas, and it was the state where they had the largest percentage of migrant men workers, you know, immigrating to the U.S. So all of these women were left, you know, without feeling very hopeless and helpless, and they really wanted to do something to help. And a lot of them, they were so successful that their husbands were able to come back and now help them grow the business.
Yeah.
So that was a pilot program. And then now now it's amazing. So one of the chocolates that I get, but I can't get it that often, we're trying to figure that out, is from one of the women.
Oh, cool.
That they do. And, you know, I give part of my proceeds, that the profits that we have, to them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very, you know, for me, I think it was important to find an organization that wasn't just giving them money, because to me, the best way to help is to give through education.
And I mean, you certainly have so many skills that you can share. I mean, as an immigrant who came to this country and started your own business and then another business.
Yeah, I've made a lot of mistakes. So, I'm always, you know, happy and open to sharing that, you know, if I can save, anybody.
It's just part of the process, I'm sure.
It's part of the process, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, it's really amazing to me what you've accomplished in such a short amount of time.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah. Fanny, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
It's really a pleasure. When is your book coming out, by the way?
The book is coming out beginning of June. I think the official date is June 8th, but you can pre-order it on Amazon. And you get a discount, I think, if you pre-order it now.
Well, that sounds good. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm very excited.
Yeah, and how many locations of Dough are there? Three now?
So we have two physical locations and then two kiosks.
Mm-hmm.
And then one, we finally have a brick and mortar for La Niurquina. Thank you. And then we have, you know, in the summer, multiple outlets and carts.
Well, I look forward to tasting all the sorbet and all the
yes,
ice cream.
Please do. You got to come try Mi Corazón.
I would love to try that.
Yes.
Fanny, thanks for coming. You are listening at home to Food Without Borders. I'm your host, Sari Kamen. See you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.